Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm from Chicago. In today's podcast, we'll be talking with Mr. Tom McCoy from Skygent. Tom, thank you for being on this podcast. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Robbie, for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so let's go ahead and get started. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you became involved in cyber and just some of the major milestones in your career, please.
Yeah, so I actually started programming in the mid-80s and wanted to access BBSs that were out of state. And so one of the things I started figuring out was that I could do some special things to the software to be able to get access to some codes that would let me be able to call people out of state without paying for it. And so that was kind of my entry into cybersecurity. It was kind of on the wrong side of things. But I ended up quickly realizing that that was not the best thing to do and kind of got on the right path. But that was my first kind of entry, was all this, coding and programming and hacking and things like that back in the 80s. And then I started my my IT career, really, in the 90s, and did that for about 20 years before I got into cyber. And about 10 years ago, I joined Dell, and I took on a role where I had responsibility for McAfee for small business and consumers, and that really was interesting to me, and then it kind of just kept going from there.
Oh, excellent. So I got to ask this one question. Was your first hacking computer the TRS-80?
No, I was a Commodore 64 guy with Commodore 64 BASIC.
All right. Okay, cool. All right.
But close.
Now, awesome. Okay. Now, can you give us an overview of Skygent? Is this the company that you created, and where is that today with its mission and technology?
Sure. Yeah. Skygent, really, we started about 9 years ago, and we're an incubation project inside of an advanced data recovery company that has been doing data recovery for 35 years now. And the idea was, okay, we know how to do advanced data recovery. What if we could put our knowledge in how we recover to prevent adversaries and bad guys and criminals from being able to get access to data? So, how do we prevent ourselves from doing what we know how to do to get data off of storage devices and media and whatnot? So that's really how it got started. It was 9 years ago. We started working with some folks in the U.S. government and said, hey, we have some ideas, and what do you think of these ideas? And kind of one thing led to another, and we ended up building out a whole portfolio of data security solutions. Today, initially focused on what we call endpoints or PCs and moving into other areas. But that's how Skygent got started. And one of the unique parts about Skygent is really that experience in advanced data recovery on storage devices and being able to look at storage and know how storage works and how encryption on storage devices and things like that work, and then being able to take that knowledge and to be able to develop some new ways to be able to protect data on endpoints that really no one has ever thought of or implemented if they did think about it.
Cool, excellent. Now, I got to ask this question. What does Skygent really mean? What does it stand for? Is there some special meaning behind it?
Well, there's not some special meaning necessarily to the term Skygent, but it's a little bit of a play on words. So a lot of the kind of expertise and experience came from some work in the signals intelligence area in the United States. So that was where the, kind of play on words, Skygent and Skygent. But, of course, in cyber, we have to say Skygent. But that is where good question.
Yeah, I like that. It's a really nice name. I really like that. So cool. Well, yeah, so where is Skygent really headed into the future? I know that a big piece of your puzzle is ransomware. So where do you plan to take your company, like, in the next coming years?
Yeah, so, I mean, today we're really focused on the endpoint or the PC, as I mentioned, and protecting data on an endpoint from ransomware, from data theft, et cetera. But we really see ourselves moving into all storage devices of any type. So everything from data center storage, which we're working on, and we're going to be releasing some capabilities in next year, so you can support enterprise servers in data centers and whatnot, all the way down to as small as a micro SD, which you could use inside of a tablet or a phone or even an IoT device, and really taking the knowledge that we have been able to implement on PC storage and really taking that same expertise and moving it into data centers and IoT and really the entire array of storage devices and even embedded storage inside of phones, things like that.
Excellent. Could you give us an overview of your products? I'm at your website. I know you got three of them, the Data Defense, Secure SSD, and a Secure SSD Plus. Is it possible to give an overview of those, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So really, you can divide Cygent's capabilities into software-only capabilities and then software plus hardware capabilities. When we started, we were focused only on the hardware piece. So putting cyber technology or cybersecurity protections at the storage level, which we think is really fundamentally the best place to put it, because you can't get any closer to your data than in the storage where that data resides. And so if you look at our secure SSD products, you'll see that we've embedded cybersecurity protections into the storage devices. For example, our SSD Plus has built-in machine learning algorithms and AI that is looking for data access patterns that are the same as ransomware. And when we see those, we can action on those, and we can even automate some of the actions from within the storage to prevent ransomware at the storage layer. So that's how we got started, and that's what you would see as kind of our kind of baseline hero feature, if you will, within the storage devices. But as we started getting into it and we started talking to a lot of different customers about their needs around data security for PCs, we quickly realized that there was a need to be able to also implement some additional capabilities that were not storage-related, but were more at the file level on a PC. So if you think about it, your files are the most valuable jewels or, you know, resources on your endpoint. It's, you know, it's where you keep your data, it's where you keep your intellectual property or your customer list or your, you know, your images that you're using for patients or whatever it is you're doing. And so what we've done is we've created some additional capabilities and a whole software product and portfolio and platform just around protecting the files, using things like multi-factor authentication and encryption and secure file sharing and things like that. So that's really kind of at the highest level, that kind of an overview of our products with the SSDs and then also with our Data Defense standalone software.
Yeah, excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base? Would it be like the Fortune 500, the SMBs, or the federal government, or probably all three of them? Or?
Yeah, it's interesting. As we've been doing this, we've really found that there isn't anybody that isn't a target customer. We have government customers that are really excited about what we're doing for data protection, obviously, for, you know, military uses or for intelligence use cases and whatnot. But then when you start getting into ransomware prevention, boy, who isn't, you know, out there that doesn't need something like that? Even our, you know, civilian agencies in the government, obviously our state and local agencies, education, healthcare, manufacturing, you know, everybody's being a target. So that's really where we focus our efforts on is today, at least, is on the kind of mid-market commercial enterprise and government. But I think over time what we'll do and what you see often with, you know, solutions like this is that we'll find a way to be able to also package it in the future for your average consumer so that they can be able to have the same levels of protection that the rest of us enjoy as well. But, yes.
Wow, that'd really be awesome. Yeah, that'd be great. I'll be one of your first customers, to be honest. So anyway.
We'd love it.
Do you have any client success stories you can share with us, like on a very general level, that who's benefited from your services?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I could go on for quite a while on ones that I can't talk about. Obviously, there's some I can't talk about. But, you know, I think a couple of years ago, we started working with a city in Florida, and they were using CARES Act funds to implement a data resiliency plan an incident response plan if there was ever a disaster or a situation where they'd have to be able to work from home or work remotely. And so they were pivoting from having desktop computers to laptops in City Hall. And they recognized that they would need to be able to have some, you know, better security. They didn't want to see a situation like we saw, you know, a few years ago, you know, where somebody were breaking in and stealing a laptop and taking it out of, you know, where it's supposed to be and getting access to the data. So that was kind of their first start. They wanted to be able to protect the data if anybody ever stole a laptop from City Hall, for example. But they also wanted to just be able to protect against ransomware. You know, they knew that they were a city that had a very limited number of resources from a definitely didn't even have a security team and didn't have a whole lot of resources to be able to prevent ransomware. And they realized how simple and easy a solution like ours would be to be able to just put it inside of your laptop, have that built-in protection at the storage level, and also adding the multi-factor authentication for files and how that would prevent the ransomware and the data theft as well. And so that was a really good story. So, and again, I could go on to more if you wanted other examples, but that's probably one of my favorites.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Now, we know that data exfiltration, whether it's intentional or not, is a huge problem. Now, how do you How does addressing that actually help mitigate the risks of a ransomware attack to begin with?
Yeah, I think, you know, years back, ransomware was really isolated to, you know, someone getting onto your network, encrypting all of your data, and then saying if you want the key to decrypt it back, you know, you would, you know, have to pay some Bitcoin or whatever it is. But then over time, we really have seen that this initial attack of stealing the data and then asking, you know, to not only get the key back, but also to prevent you from, or friend and adversary from extorting you by putting your data on the dark web. That's really become kind of the new, you know, kind of playbook, if you will, of the ransomware attackers. And we're even starting to see some people that are not even doing the ransomware encryption part. They're just doing the stealing your data and then, you know, saying if you don't pay, we're going to put it up on the dark web. So data, you know, exfiltration prevention or protecting the data from being stolen, I think is more important even than preventing the ransomware. And so what we've done at Sygint is a couple of different things. One is that we have this very simple capability that's multi-factor authentication for file access. And so what we do is we encrypt files on an endpoint, we add this layer of MFA, and it's very customizable by the company to decide whether or not they want to have it always require MFA for certain files or just sometimes, and it's very, you know, flexible based on what they need, based on how important that data is. But that MFA at the file level consistently prevents a ransomware attack and a data theft attack, and also gives you early warning that somebody's on the system. So that's one of the things that we do. The second thing that we do is we create secure vaults on storage devices. And the nice part about these vaults is that when you turn on your computer, the vault remains locked. And it's just like a safe, you know, and it's not just encryption, because encryption's great, but you can still steal files or you can double encrypt files if it's available. But this lock, the way that we do it, or this vault, the way that we do it, is completely locked. And so you can't even read the sectors of the storage device while it's in this state. One of the attacks that we just have heard about recently, they were using basically software to do reconnaissance on PCs to see what files were out there and what was there. It's the Volt Typhoon attack that was just announced a few weeks ago. And we tested that attack on our systems with this locked vault, and they weren't able to see the data at all. So in this situation, they would have ran and done recon to see where the data was. They would have looked at the system and said, nope, there's nothing here, and moved on to the next system, and just, you know, probably ultimately go out to the next company because they wouldn't have seen anything of value to steal from this company. So that kind of combination is really what we think is super valuable for customers. And, you know, it also prevents cloning and all sorts of other things the way that we've developed it. So not just the remote attacks, but even the direct physical attacks you might be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Now, have any of your clients actually experienced a extortion attack or having their PII data sets sold on the dark web?
Yes, and of course you can't talk too much about that because they want to keep that information quiet.
Right.
But yeah, that happens all the time, you know, where people get, you know, that we work with have had those attacks. And so, you know, they're of course very happy to be able to say that, you know, with our, you know, technology in our company that they've been able to avoid having to, you know, pay those fines or deal with that. And they can also recover more quickly too. So.
Okay, excellent. That's another side question. When you talk about multi-factor authentication, does Sygint make use of biometrics? Like, you know, facial or iris or fingerprint recognition, like another layer of confirming the identity?
So we offer that as an option to our customers and ultimately that to the decision of the IT department of whatever company is or security department to decide. But, yes, you know, we have an option where you can use facial recognition or fingerprint to be able to access your data if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Now, Tom, you know the cyber attacker is always, you know, two steps ahead. You know, kind of like a, you know, one step forward, two steps back with the people, you know, with the victims. But ransomware is an always ever changing malware, I guess, right? If you want to put it that way. How do you make sure that your technology stays ahead of that cyber attacker, that threat variant that they want to launch?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges that we've seen in the industry is that people that are trying to prevent ransomware are using traditional detection capabilities to be able to see if they can determine if there's going to be ransomware. So, and they're looking at, you know, same model that we came out with a few years ago in the industry with machine learning for finding malware, is they're looking at maybe an actual executable, a file that's running, and they're saying, well, if I see this one again or something looks similar to it, I'm going to stop it, or I'm going to, you know, maybe look at a process or a set of processes, and if I see that same process or set of processes, I'm going to prevent it. And I think that's flawed because what happens is that adversaries just get the same tools that our systems are using. They do recon to figure out what you know, antivirus or EDR we're using, and they go set up in their lab and they just figure out how they can bypass and remain avoided. And so what we've done at SciGen is a completely different approach, which is why I think we're so effective. And that's that our ransomware machine learning algorithms are not based on looking at processes or files that are running, but they're actually based on data access patterns at the detailed, you know, deep storage level. And the nice part about that is that ransomware is very consistent in how it acts and how it behaves. You know, it does a read of a file, and then it rewrites it in an encrypted state. And it does that over and over and over and over and over again. And so when I'm looking at data access patterns, I can see consistently that there's a ransomware attack, and I can be able to prevent it because I'm not looking at, again, the files. I'm looking at the read-write patterns in the storage. And so we also have assumed and realized that we are not perfect and that adversaries, no matter what we come up with, they find a way around it. And so the other approach we've taken is to make sure that our ability in our algorithms and our machine learning is set up in such a way that we can easily upgrade it and modify it over time, even though it's at the storage level. So we have a dedicated microprocessor that runs our AI on it, and we have a way to securely update that to make sure that if we do detect some way that somebody's trying to bypass us, and we can modify our algorithms to be able to catch it and then upgrade those devices in the field.
Okay, excellent. Now, AI, I was going to talk about that here a little bit later on here on the show, but I guess we may bring it up now. AI, what are your thoughts on AI in general? How do you make use of it, you know, without giving any, you know, your secret sauces for SciGen? What do you think about ChatGPT? Let's just throw a whole thing out there, kid.
Next thing you're going to ask me about, what do I think about government policy preventing us from it and using it? But so I think AI has been amazing for the industry, right? You know, if you go back, you know, 10 years ago and look at what we were doing, you know, we were using just, you know, signature-based AV, and that was not, you know, being able to maintain muster against the bad guys. And so, you know, AI comes out, and we were able to implement machine learning and had a really significant impact on malware on systems. You know, we really don't see anywhere near as much malware on PCs as we see, you know, process-based or live-off-the-land attacks because of how successful we've been with AI. And I think that you look at, you know, people like us that are looking at different ways to use AI to prevent attacks, and there's lots of them out there, right, like us that are coming up with new ways to do it. And you see us, you know, inventing this idea of, you know, let's look at the data access patterns instead of just the processes to be able to detect and prevent malware. So you see that great evolution coming in the prevention perspective. But I do think we definitely have to be cautious and concerned about, you know, how AI is being used in nefarious ways to be able to, you know, for example, create spear phishing attacks in emails that are significantly more compelling and more realistic than anything we've ever seen. And I think what happens, too, is that we're going to see more and more of your kind of your attackers who are maybe wouldn't have been at the same level as they were. Maybe they're new into the industry or younger even and don't have as much experience, but they're able to evolve and they're able to implement attacks that are significantly, you know, more advanced than what they could have done on their own because they can use something like a ChatGPT to develop, you know, code and attacks and things like that. So I think that we'll start to see that, especially as you go down into things like even students that are using ChatGPT to create attacks on schools and things like that. So I think it's something to be super concerned about and to be aware of and to, you know, do our best to try to figure out what the best way is, you know, culturally within organizations as well as within the government to use the resources they have to still allow people to have freedom because we don't, you know, we love our freedom here in the United States, which we need, but to be able to also, you know, consider how we can be able to put some measures and controls and monitor activity to be able to ensure that that doesn't kind of get out of hand, if you will.
Right. Well, I keep getting asked this, you know, being a writer and having been writing stuff about this. My view is that, you know, I think AI, we're kind of going through another dot-com craze. It's just a theory right now. I think honestly, it's going to die down. And it's just going to, it's going to be here, but I don't think it's going to be end all of society is what people are worrying about. Because it's interesting because my dad was actually a professor of neurobiology at Purdue, and he was involved in spinal cord regeneration research, so he did a lot of work into the human brain. And he said, at best, humankind will only understand maybe a 0.5% of what the human brain is. We will never understand completely. And I think what the myth is, what people have out there, is that we'll understand 100% and we'll mimic the brain 100%, and that's never, ever going to happen. But that's what I tell people. Mm. But anyway, that's worse.
Yep.
Okay, but talk about the government. Biden, in my book I included that he actually came out with what they call an AI Bill of Rights, actually. And I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but it's to level the playing ground between the AI vendors and us American, average everyday citizens, to see, give us a choice if we want to be categorized by an AI machine or have a human do it or what they do with our data. So it's quite intriguing. If you want to see that, I can send you a copy of that if you'd like to see that. It's really quite intriguing. So anyway.
Yeah,
so,
that would be great.
Okay, so back to the topic of ransomware. So anyway, so now, Tom, we all are at risk of being hit with a ransomware attack, right? I mean, we can never be, bulletproof against it. But what can we do to mitigate that risk? What are some of those proactive steps that we can take so that we can perhaps lower the statistical odds of being hit by that ransomware attack?
Yeah, I think what I would suggest to organizations is to not look at the minimum requirements to meet whatever compliance that they feel that they have to meet as kind of the bar that they have to set for themselves to be able to be protected against ransomware. What we see is, some of the greatest cybersecurity, companies out there in the world, that have developed XDR and all these things, all the big name guys, that their customers are getting hit with ransomware. I mean, it's just a reality, right? And so I don't think that you can look at kind of your typical measures that we have out there in the XDR platforms that require this army of people to look at everything, or even a managed service provider who's going to come in here and supposedly help you out and make sure that you are prevented from that. I think you have to really look at some new approaches like what we're doing and what others are doing that aren't required by compliance and aren't required by law, because it takes a long time for regulation and for policy to catch up with technology. It takes many, 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 many years. And in the meantime, you have access to tools that could be put into place that would allow you to truly prevent ransomware. But you have to think outside the box, and you have to be creative, and you have to look at other newer vendors that are coming out there in the field so that you can get that newer technology ahead of the curve of policy and of requirements. And things like what we're doing with MFA for file access, or using, machine learning and ransomware and things like that inside of the storage, are some of those ideas that I would suggest people take a serious look at. I know a little self-serving, but I do think that it's kind of a typical issue that we have across the board with, privacy and data theft and whatnot, is the policy is just not enough. Unfortunately, too many people are just focused on, kind of meeting the minimum bar of policy requirements.
Right. Well, we've talked a lot about EDR and XDR. Are your solutions, are they meant for on-prem or the cloud or both?
We do both. So we have solutions that are for cloud. We can, so the on-prem and cloud is kind of two different things that you're talking about. One is, where is your central console hosted is one of the kind of angles with on-prem and cloud. The other is whether or not your systems can access the cloud, whether they're air-gapped or whether they're on-premise. And so we have solutions on both sides. We have a console that's hosted in Azure that you can get access to from anywhere, but we have a lot of customers that are air-gapped, so they can put our console inside of an air-gapped on-premise environment. And then we also have solutions for file protection, for example, that works with the clouds. So if you encrypt your files and protect them on your PC, when you sync them or you email them or you put them in a cloud share to work with other people or even a network file share, you can still have that availability. So we've really tried to think about all the different scenarios that people are using their data and come up with a comprehensive approach.
Okay, excellent. Now, does your technology do other components of like a cloud infrastructure or on-prem infrastructure, can they benefit from your technology other than just the endpoints and ransomware?
Today we're really focused on the kind of the endpoint or the PC, right? So that's really where our, apart from, files that get shared outside of the endpoint, that's really where we're started. But as I mentioned earlier, we are working on data center solutions. So we'll be able to have a lot of the protections that we offer in the ransomware, machine learning and things like that inside of your enterprise data center storage devices, which will really help make a big difference to protect and prevent adversaries from getting access to it. So that's one thought. The other thing is to look at us and think about us as a data resiliency approach, which is, a lot of people consider their infrastructure, consider their backups, their on-premise as the answer to that. What we've done at SciGen that's a little bit different is to be able to have a backup of your data on the local PC. So you can use our technology to create a vault where you back up your data from your PC onto your PC so that in the event that you are compromised and you get your data encrypted, that you're able to then revert directly back to the PC itself to be able to recover the data as opposed to trying to figure out how to get this PC to connect to your infrastructure when you've shut everything down because you're in the middle of an attack. So I think that there's a little bit different angle, but it still addresses the same challenge. And then over time, we're also working on some things that'll lead into IoT and, you know, printers and things like that. So it'll really span beyond just the endpoint PC, if you will.
Okay, excellent. Now, we talked a little bit about your clients. Or what industries do you focus on, or what's like your industrial, like healthcare or financial organizations or anything like that?
Yeah, those are two of the big ones. Healthcare still has a huge challenge with a lot of their data, with patient records. I always, you know, mention to people, like, when was the last time you received, you know, anything related to your personal medical records and whatnot, you know, encrypted by anybody that you work with? And the answer is, you know, probably never. And I think there's a big gap and a big issue there. And, you know, getting back to something you mentioned earlier about AI and people, you know, working on profiles of you and things like that, you know, our access to our data, even our the most important information about our health records and whatnot, is being, you know, sent decrypted in a way that is, you know, over email, which, you know, is not the most secure way to send information. So I think, you know, definitely the healthcare agencies and industry really is learning to greatly benefit from what we're doing. Obviously, financial services, manufacturers lately have been a really, you know, big target of an attack, so they're greatly benefiting from technologies like ours. So it's really anybody who has files that are on their PCs, and so you can think about that as like your folks that are doing R&D, you know, the latest and greatest research and designs, or whether it be even movie makers and people that are creating, you know, first-party content. You know, they're doing that on their endpoint PCs, which is where they want to be doing it because they've got powerful PCs that can do all of that that work, that R&D research or the, you know, movie creation and things like that, or AutoCAD or whatever it is. So anybody really who's storing that information locally on a PC and wants to protect it. And then, of course, we have, you know, a significant number of benefits for government agencies and things like that based on what we're doing as well.
Okay, excellent. Now, Tom, there are tons of other cyber vendors out there, and they, you know, they state they have their claim to fame. Oh, we'll stop running ransomware attacks. We'll calculate your cyber score. It may look like your credit score. Anyway, what separates you from the rest of the crowd? Why should I come to you and say, hey, can you help me protect my endpoints and help me mitigate a ransomware attack, the possibilities of that person is going to XYZ company down the road?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of companies that are doing net new things, you know, in different areas of cyber, and you do really need to have a comprehensive portfolio of capabilities that span everything in your infrastructure, right, for your networks and your identity and access management, things like that. So not at all, you know, just saying that, you know, all of those are really valuable. But I think what's unique and different about us and what you have to look at is look at a company and look at kind of what patents do they have. Do they have patents that are unique and different? Do they have a significant number of those? And are they in areas that nobody really is doing anything in? If you think about your endpoint PCs and you think about data security specifically for endpoints, there really aren't that many people that are still playing in that space and still trying to innovate in that space. And SciGen's one of the only companies out there. The industry used to have a bunch of people, and they still say that they're in endpoints, right? The EDR is endpoint detection and response. But if you look at pretty much all of those vendors, they've all moved to XDR, which is extended detection and response. And the EDR portion is really a motion to be able to look at the activity on an endpoint and use that activity in conjunction with all the endpoint or the other information across your network and your infrastructure to be able to see what adversaries are doing. So they pivoted a little bit away from really, in my humble opinion, endpoint protection and pivoted towards more of an infrastructure protection. And so it's really left a lot of open gaps within your endpoint protection, especially from specifically a data protection on the endpoint. You know, the other vendors in this space are ones that have been around a long time. They're using things like, you know, basically full disk encryption or things like that, which is a very old technology at this point. And we need to look at new technologies and new approaches like what we're doing that's unique. And it's really that ability to you know, create vaults that are secure after you boot into Windows. You know, all the other solutions are opening up all your files and decrypting them as soon as you log into Windows, for example. You know, or looking at solutions that are really trying to do file level encryption and protection in an easy way to make it easy for you as a user and the recipients of that data to be able to get access to the data. And then, of course, you know, putting in ransomware machine learning into storage is just completely innovative, and nobody's done anything quite like it out there at all. So that's what I think really uniquely separates us from other people that are in the same field.
Okay, excellent. Now, the next couple of questions is going to be on a topic that's kind of dear to me. I guess we were talking before the podcast. And it's one of the biggest buzzwords right now in cybersecurity. It is that of zero trust. Now, how does Cygent incorporate the principles of the zero framework into your ransomware products and solutions?
Yeah, I find this topic really fascinating because when Zero Trust first came out, the concept of it several years ago, it was really about networks, right? And it was, we were all still kind of mostly working in offices, right? And so it was really this idea of, you know, when I connect to my Active Directory or I connect to my network, by default, I'm exposed to everything. I have access to everything, and then they set policy to be able to shut down access to everything that you shouldn't have access to, which if they make any mistakes in that, then you have access to something you shouldn't get access to, right? And so that's how it all started. Critical, super important, you know, area to be able to button down to switch to the zero trust where you log in and you get access to nothing and you have to be added to it. So I think that's great. And I, unfortunately, over the last few years, what we've seen is anybody and everybody that's in cybersecurity just calls whatever they're doing is zero trust, right? And so it looks very cloudy, and it is very cloudy. But I think what's come out of it is that people have started to say, you know what, zero trust for my network makes sense, but what about zero trust for my application? Like, let's say my, you know, my ERP solution that has access to everything in my company. Maybe I need to start off with zero trust with that as well, right? Instead of, you know, opening up everything, just open it up to, you know, nothing and then add, you know, add capabilities for people to access different things. And so what we're starting to see is a wise application of a great philosophy for networks to other areas. And so if you think about that from an endpoint computer perspective, an endpoint PC perspective, we sort of have that, right? You know, you log into your PC and you have to prove that you're you, and then you get access to what's on the CS system. The problem is that we have to assume compromise, assume the adversary is also on my PC. So if I do that, then I've just opened up my entire PC to, you know, to this adversary, and everything on my PC is accessible to that adversary. So if you implement the concept of zero trust down to the PC level, what do? You implement it at the file level. Okay, so you say every single file now is kind of like accessing my ERP or accessing my network. Every single file now assumes that I don't have access to it, and I have to prove that I say who I am and able to have access to it. So that's where MFA for file access, which we have, we're the only ones that are doing this today, has really comes in, right? So I take a file, any file that maybe it's something I'm working on with the government, controlled and classified information, or maybe it's a HIPAA record or something, and I say, nobody can have access to this except for me. And the way that we do that is when you click on a file, it prompts you, and I have to prove through MFA, whether it be, like you mentioned earlier, face unlock or fingerprint, or my favorite is Duo Security by Cisco, you know, using that to be able to authenticate to prove that. And when I do that, that prevents access to that file by anybody else on the system that's there. And so we apply that at the file level, and the other place we apply that is, naturally, as you can imagine, in our secure vaults, right? So our secure vaults is a portion of the drive that's locked, it's unreadable by an adversary, and I'm the only one who can get access to that with my credentials and my trusted authentication. So we're passionate about that. We think that's really, you know, the future direction is to add zero trust at the file and at the storage level so you can make sure to really protect your data from that kind of adversaries lurking within.
Oh, excellent. Okay, cool. Yeah, because when I wrote about this stuff in my manuscript in the book, I didn't really mention about zero trust at the file level, and that's something I kind of wish I would have wrote more about. Well, the way I looked at it was more at a macro level, you know, of netting out your IT and network structure and having, like, each having sort of layer defense and have MFA in there. But, yeah, maybe I can make an update book in a couple of years and talk at the file level. That'd be great.
Second edition.
Yeah, hey, if you want to be a co-author, let me know. Hey, I can definitely do that, too.
There you go.
Have to wait for a minute.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, that'd be great. Now, kind of segue into some different topics in cyber, and not so much about ransomware. I have a few of them I just want to get your thoughts on really quick. The Internet of Things, you kind of briefly touched about that. I find that to be a very scary proposition when everything's all connected. I mean, for example, I know people have a smart car, and when they clap their hands, your car backs up. I mean, I still drive an 03 Honda Civic, you know, all analog instrumentation, and I'm really happy with that. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a smart home, but what are your thoughts on the IoT? I mean, do you have a smart car or a smart home? Or?
I've been fighting it, you know, tooth and nail, but it's almost impossible to not have IoT devices start creeping in. So I have a lot of different perspectives on it. When I was at Dell, we started rolling out some IoT servers, basically, that would be able to be placed to manage a bunch of IoT devices. And we started looking into and digging into, like, how would you secure the servers that we were hosting there on-premise that were managing those devices, as well as the actual IoT edge, you know, components and things like that. And, you know, a couple of the things that I learned from that were, one of them was to make sure you have really good secure communications between your IoT endpoint device and whatever it's communicating with. You know, we can think about man-in-the-middle attacks and things like that, and that's really where you have to make sure that your communication path all the way from whatever's talking to, whether it be receiving information or sending commands down to that device is very, very secure. And the other part of it, and this is just a general, you know, with all technology, whether it be a computer and its BIOS or whatever it is to make sure that your authentication into that device is very secure. So doing things like certificate-based authentication and things like that to make sure that, you know, only certain, people can access those devices if they need to. And then I'm a big believer having the Cygent lens a little, at least, of looking at adding cyber protections into the components of storage itself, right? Since we've been able to come up with an ID8, some capabilities on endpoints and then data centers and servers inside of their storage that really helps protect the data, I kind of have that same concept and philosophy with an edge device. Like if I can put cyber protections and ransomware detection and, you know, hardware encryption and file level encryption and things like that at the actual edge, I think that's a really great approach because it allows me to protect the data if somebody ever tries to, you know, steal that edge device and tries to get the data or if they try to do anything nefarious with it. You know, like shutting down, you know, ransomware has been used in the past to be able to shut down edge devices, right, because they encrypt them and they steal the key and things like that. So if I can be able to have ways to detect that and prevent that from within the storage on the IoT device, I think that's kind of really amazing way to prevent those attacks. So those are my thoughts. What are your thoughts?
I think it's scary. Honestly, I'm just kind of coming as a shock to you, but I hate technology. I really do. As much as I love Azure, Microsoft, and you know, I think it's great. It's interesting. I only have two mobile apps on my iPhone, which is one for my email and one for, like, Google Maps. Right? I stay away from tech. I hate it. I really do. It's just I get so sick of it. You know, well,
I love it.
I'm not young.
So, I always have.
Well, I mean, I like it, but it's – I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy that way, you know. And, you know, I'm not even on social media. The only thing I'm really on is on LinkedIn. And, you know, it's just – you know, and that's why I'm happy with my old Honda Civic. You know, I've had to put some money in lately, but it's still so anyway, cool.
I'll make sure to send you my thank you note after this via snail mail to make sure you get it.
Oh, I love snail mail more than I love getting email. You don't know how many emails to get a day. Like, oh, download this new app or download this new newsletter from a. It's like 50 a day. Anyway, enough of my soapbox. But anyway, now the next topic is the data privacy laws, you know, like the GDPR, CCPA, you know, blah, 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 HIPAA. Do your clients actually use tools to come into compliance with those?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody has to try to comply with those. And I was just talking to an analyst about this topic yesterday. And I think my couple of, you know, my thoughts and soap opera a little bit would be, one is I think a lot of those policies are really out of date. You know, if you go back to some of them, they're still 15 years ago when we just had full disk encryption or, you know, my biggest one, pet peeve, is BitLocker, you know, where we, you know, BitLocker somehow checks the box off for compliance for, you know, protecting data on endpoints, which is it doesn't, and I think pretty much everybody knows that at this point, or hope they do. So I think that the compliance regulations need some updating for protecting data on endpoints. And I think in general, you know, as everybody has seen with GDPR and things like that, with these really broad ones with tons of fairly open to interpretation or very open to interpretation regulation policies, is that they're not really successful, honestly. They just give an arm of a body to be able to go and to find somebody if they don't think that they're doing something right. But I think that we need to be a lot crisper in what we're doing from a policy perspective to make sure that people are getting the technology that they need to. And I think, you know, another way, you know, that's kind of like the stick. I kind of like the idea of the carrot more, right? So the carrot is, you know, I use the example of, you know, when COVID came out, there was a pandemic, right, of course. And so our government was wise enough to be able to invest into buying vaccines and making those available for free. So they did that, and then people were able to afford it. We were able to reach a lot of people. Well, ransomware is a pandemic. What's our government and what is the world doing to be able to make solutions that can prevent ransomware be free?
Right.
You know, that's better than the stick. The carrot is, you know what, let me help you, you know, customer, with something that's really innovative and really stops ransomware, and I'm going to help fund it or co-fund it, or just, you know, maybe it's just for the critical infrastructure or something like that. But I think that's really a better approach, honestly, than the stick. That kind of depends on the judge and jury to decide, you know, how I'm going to implement that and find people.
Yeah, interesting perspective. Never really thought about them that way. Another issue I kind of have with these data privacy laws is that, you know, every state's kind of putting out their own version of the GDPR and CCPA. And one thing that I'm going to hope, if I can get to it May next year, is to write a white paper on what I'm proposing as a need for the Department of Cybersecurity. Remember after 9/11, I think George Bush, he kind of immediately started the DHS to centralize all, you know, intelligence efforts, you know, on the war on terrorism. But I think we need a Department of Cybersecurity to kind of centralize all of these laws, you know, so everybody will follow one set of standards and best practices. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I find, you know, our model of government with the states and with the federal government to be really fascinating. And, you know, the ability for certain states to be able to decide kind of what they want the world to look like for people in that state. I could definitely see an opportunity to have a, you know, cross-country regulation as opposed to a by-state for something like this, as long as it was done in a way that was, you know, appropriate and whatnot. So, yeah, I think it's very, very fascinating to see all the states try to come in there and try to, like you look at like Montana with, you know, trying to ban, you know, TikTok and things like that. You know, it's just very fascinating to see all the states kind of trying to do their own thing. But I think it's really challenging for the federal government to try to find something that everybody will agree on, which is probably why there's been a little bit of a, you know, hesitation to be able to implement policy like that.
Okay. Now, another one is COVID-19, the remote workforce. You know, when nobody ever thought it would change the world like it did. Luckily, now we don't hear much about it. It's pretty much gone. But how did it impact your business, and how did it impact the way you're doing work right now with your clients?
It has had a major, I think, long-term watershed shift in how people work. And even you see companies that are going back to work, they're not all going back in the same way that they were. And, I'm here in Austin outside of Round Rock where Dell is, and, you know, they've gone back to a full-time hybrid model where, you know, more and more people are able to go live if they want to live out of state, but that's okay. That's a big shift. And then also to be able to have people not in every single day. So what that changes is it changes that this idea of, you know, being able to have your cybersecurity protections be within the walls of the network, that's pretty much gone forever unless you're an agency, you know, U.S. government agency. So I think that's shifted a lot. I think in some ways it's been fantastic for work because it's allowed us to be able to achieve a whole lot more and to have kind of the culture shifted to it is acceptable and it is okay to get a lot more done over Zoom than we ever, you know, were able to do before. But at the same time, it's just not the same. You know, when I get to get with my team and get to get with the colleagues and we're in person, it is a night and day difference of the amount of benefit that we can have and about how deep we go, not only relationally, of course, but also in just, you know, work and being able to have those conversations. There's just something completely different about the in-person experience that we just have lost. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us to be able to figure out how to continue to go to events, ideally, where we can be able to see more and more people at once and to be able to continue to get back on the road, if you will, if we need to, or to go in person to see people and make that, be very intentional about that.
Right. Okay. Well, the final topic I want to kind of bring up here is cybersecurity insurance. You brought that up, you know, with the ransomware, you know, attacks, and insurance companies are now making, you know, people, you know, go through all these internal audits, self-assessments. Have you helped, what are your thoughts on cyber insurance? Have you helped your clients like get cyber insurance? And what do you think about the insurance companies not even paying out? Like if someone actually did pay a ransom, like in the Colonial Gas Pipeline, I think they still pay like $4 million or so. They're not doing that anymore. The insurance companies don't pay that out. What are your thoughts on all this?
Man, I don't know very many people who think that, you know, their insurance, whether it be cyber or whether it be personal insurance, is exactly the way that they wish it would be. I think all of us have kind of a perception of that about insurance. So I think cyber insurance kind of falls into that same category, and I think it's really painful for customers. You know, nowadays, you know, the CISO, if you talk to a CISO about it, you know, they're going to immediately tense up, right, because they've got this 70-page document now that they're supposed to fill out and all these audit controls and whatnot. And then to your point, you know, it's just becoming less and less where they're going to pay out and things like that. So I really struggle with the idea of paying. You know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, it seems like, unfortunately, we haven't been able to have that be kind of the rule of law, if you will, or not the rule of law, but the way that organizations have been able to behave when they are, you know, held ransom in their entire, you know, company that they've worked so hard to make successful is they're, you know, hanging on a wire. So I understand definitely why people do it, but man, I would just wish that we could get to a state where we could just stop and have enough of our data protected so that when somebody does get hit, they don't even need it. You know, they don't need the insurance to pay the ransom, or they don't need to pay the ransom. And I think if we can get there, we're going to see a monumental shift in the industry, because the adversaries are just going to be less motivated to go after it. And, you know, granted, they might do other things, but at least we can really have a very significant impact on kind of the financing of a lot of these bad actors. I'm very optimistic that's where the industry can get to, is actually truly to prevent ransomware so we can stop this altogether.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if I'm correct, but isn't that like an act of treason against the U.S. if someone pays the ransom, if I'm correct?
I'm not aware of that. No, I just know that we have some laws that we're trying to pass here in Texas that, you know, prevent people from paying certain people and certain groups. So
yeah, okay.
I think it's a fascinating topic too. That too, because, you know, what do you? Everything has kind of a, you know, positive side, and then it also has a very detrimental side of it too. You know, if we roll out those kind of policies, so it's a great topic.
Yeah. Okay, well, now here's a $60,000 question. It's a very broad question, but where do you think these cyber industries headed, and where do you think all these cyber threats, what do you think the biggest next threat variant is going to be?
I'm really optimistic that we get and turn a curve from what I see as a lot of pessimism over the last few years at the shows, probably started about 3 years ago, when people started to say, you know what, data resiliency is now the answer, which data resiliency basically is defeat in my mind. And instead, we can say, you know what, we can actually make a difference. We can actually stop it. I'm of the mindset of the, you know, we shall not fail, or we will not fail, or, you know, failure is not an option. So that's my mindset and our team's mindset. We are not going to give up until we actually prevent. So I'm optimistic that we move away from detection solutions, which is where everybody pivoted to. You know, if you go back to the original NIST cyber framework, prevention was, you know, the first step, right? And, you know, what I think is a lot of people just said, look, we're failing at prevention, so let's try to do better detection. And then it went from better detection to, well, let's just be resilient because we can't, you know, stop the bad guys. So my hope in my vision and future for the industry, where I'm going to be committed to until, you know, I see it through, or until I, you know, go to the grave, is to basically say, look, we're going to figure out a way to actually be successful in stopping this. I would say, you know, beyond kind of my desire would be that I think that you're going to start to see policy that's got more teeth in it. I think you're going to see people getting more specific. You know, if you can look at some of the regulations from like NSA, CSSC office and things like that, who are really, really quite, you know, crisp on even down to what algorithms they recognize are acceptable and not acceptable for encryption and decryption, because they've done and seen, you know, where all the attacks are. And I think if we can start to see some of that come down so that we have laws and regulations that guide better, you know, things like CMMC are great, but you can implement CMMC in a way where you actually aren't protecting your files, which is sad. I can go through all this work and still not actually protect the CUI. You can do better at, you know, access controls or policy, but you're still not actually protecting the files. So I think that over time, as, you know, technologies become more ubiquitous and more available that can actually protect and prevent attacks, that you'll start to see more policy that's crisper and more better, you know, describing what the users or what the companies have to implement to actually truly protect and prevent their data from being lost and stolen. So that's my 60,000-foot view of the future.
Okay, well, excellent. Now, finally, Tom, if someone wants to know more about ransomware or services or any of the other topics we've talked about in this podcast, what is the best way to have them contact you?
Well, we follow, like everybody else, SciGent.com. We try to make our website really the best source for it. Our resources section is pretty rich in information like that. This podcast will be up there in the resources section as well. But really, you know, take a look at our website, give us a call, let us talk to you, let us come visit with you in person. We'd love to be able to do that. So really, SciGent.com is the best starting point.
Excellent. Well, Tom, we thank you for being on our show this afternoon, and we look forward to having you on future future podcasts.
Well, thank you, Robbie. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care.